The retirement and IRA show represents the words and views of the show hosts exclusively and should not be construed as investment, legal, or tax advice. All information is believed to be from reliable sources. However, we make no representation as to its completeness or accuracy. All economic and performance information is historical in nature and is not indicative of any future results. Any indices mentioned on the show are unmanaged and cannot be invested in directly. Diversification and asset allocation strategies do not assure profit or protect against loss. Never make any investment or financial decisions based on information offered on this show without first consulting your financial, legal, or tax advisor. Securities offered through Cambridge Investment Research Incorporated, a broker-dealer member FINRA SIPC. Advisory services offered through Cambridge Investment Research Advisors Incorporated, a registered investment advisor. Financial planning services offered through Jim Saulnier & Associates, LLC, a registered investment advisor. Jim Saulnier & Associates, LLC, and Cambridge are not affiliated.
This is the Retirement and IRA Show coming to you from beautiful Northern Colorado. Join us as certified financial planner Jim Saulnier, as well as Colorado State University finance instructor and certified financial planner Chris Stein, teach you about IRAs, 401ks, annuities, Social Security, pension plans, and estate planning in a fun and enjoyable show. Whether you are listening live in Colorado or streaming from their website or iTunes podcast, Jim and Chris want you to know that they're available to help you plan for your retirement. Just visit their website at jimhelps.com. That's Jim, H-E-L-P-S.com. And click the Meet the Team button on the homepage. Now, here's Jim and Chris with today's show.
Well, welcome to the Retirement and IRA Show Q&A edition. Today's going to be a Social Security Q&A, specifically. Jim got out late to his elk hunt, so he's not back in time. So I decided now's a good day to clean up a bunch of outstanding Social Security questions that we have here. Those are easy to do when it's when I'm flying solo. Allows me to knock these out for you, get caught up on the Social Security questions. So no Jim today. He let me know this morning his harvesting attempt. That's what we call it instead of hunting or killing out here in the West, if you will. His harvesting attempt on his elk has not been successful quite yet, but we're got our fingers crossed for him today. I'm sure we'll hear all about it in next week's show, so stay tuned for the results. Last year he didn't get one, so my guess is he's going to be extraordinarily annoyed if he doesn't get one this year. Anyway, so we've got some Social Security questions here, a variety of topics, actually, surrounding some real potpourri, if you will, or a cornucopia. We're heading into fall, so I guess that's a more appropriate description. But this one comes in fairly recently, September. This came in earlier September, and has a couple elements to it. So I'll just start onto it. It says, I'm a retired postal worker under CSRS, so that's the predecessor to FERS, the Federal Employee Retirement System. So CSRS was the version that was standalone, didn't also participate in Social Security, by the way. He retired at 57 to take care of his special needs son and has roughly 38 years of service, including military time, but I don't have enough to qualify for Social Security and would be very much affected by GPO. Anyway, now GPO would only affect him if he's collecting a survivor or spousal benefit on his spouse's record. WEP is what would be affecting his own retirement benefit from Social Security if he had had one. So in this particular case, just to be clear, he may or may not be accurate in talking about GPO versus WEP. But his question is regarding his wife. She was born in the Philippines. She arrived in the U.S. in 1986, so been here for a long time as a naturalized citizen, but only earned about $2,600 that the first year she got here. He listens to our podcast and went to our blog, helpwithmysocialsecurity.com, by the way, is kind of an extension on the podcast here. We do a lot of Social Security questions here on the podcast, the general Q&A show for the Retirement and IRA show, but we have a specific blog where all we talk about is Social Security. If you're interested, just go to helpwithmysocialsecurity.com, all one word, one giant word, helpwithmysocialsecurity.com. But he went there, saw, read one of my posts about the GPO and has a question. So She did not pay into Social Security from 1995 to 2001 because she worked as a nurse and contributed to a defined contribution plan. He says, is a 401A the same as a defined contribution plan? So generally, yes, a 401A effectively is a form of a defined contribution plan. It's what a lot of government and academic institutions use for as a replacement for a 401K. So, but that's a side issue. The investments are with, this is not important, some with the employer, but under the same umbrella. If she does not touch the money until the age of 72, would that delay her being affected by GPO? She plans to retire at age 62. By that time, she should have 29 years of substantial earnings. How much would it affect GPO, her Social Security, if she transfers it to an IRA? Well, let me clarify something here. He's talking about GPO this whole time. He really means WEP, Windfall Elimination Provision. GPO only affects a survivor or spousal benefit that you are trying to collect, not your own benefit. That's the difference. WEP affects your own benefit. GPO affects spousal and survivor benefits that you might be collecting. He's talking about her collecting her own Social Security benefit, but she has this defined contribution plan that she participated in for about 6 years from 95 to 2001, and that is going to trigger WEP and possibly GPO. In her case, not GPO, because he does not have a Social Security benefit upon which she can claim as a spouse. So again, he's written GPO here over and over and over again. What he really means is WEP, Windfall Elimination Provision. So let me back up and substitute that. How much would WEP affect her Social Security if she transfers it to an IRA? The it here is that defined contribution plan. To simplify things, if she transfers all the money but leaves it under the umbrella of a defined contribution plan, would affect, that's not really possible. I've been diagnosed with cancer, but luckily things are going well. God forbid I would outlive her. What would happen to her defined contribution plan if I would outlive her? That's a secondary issue. So let's get back to his real question in all of that. Sorry to be, I guess I should have summarized it a little bit better, but his basic question in all of this is, how much will that defined contribution plan she participated in as a non-covered pension, is what the phrase is, how will it affect her Social Security? And if she waited until 72 to touch any of that money, would it delay the triggering of WEP? Well, first of all, WEP, the maximum WEP offset, and I don't have down to the penny in front of me, but in 2020, it's about $500 is the maximum. Now, she's got one thing that, one key figure here, she plans to retire at 62, but she should have 29 years of substantial earnings with Social Security in that case. Well, at 30 years of substantial earnings, WEP goes away completely. So she's going to have very, very little. She's not even going to be close to that maximum amount of WEP offset, that almost $500 figure I mentioned. Hers, that starts to be reduced in as little as 20 years of substantial earnings. So she's at 29. If she had 30, it would be completely eliminated, any WEP offset. But for her, there's going to be a tiny one if she sticks at that 29. I'd want to see the earnings record and count them all to make sure that she's actually at 29. Hopefully she's truly at 30 by that time. But there'll be a tiny offset. And yes, it only starts once the first distribution is made from that defined contribution plan. So if you delay taking any of the money out, as long as no money's been taken out so far, they won't apply WEP. It's when you first become entitled to that, quote, pension. You might say, well, a defined contribution plan isn't a pension. For purposes of WEP, they decide that it is a pension because it was a substitute for Social Security at that particular employer. So she is going to be affected by WEP a tiny bit, given the facts that he gave me. but it's going to be very, I would say, insignificant because she's got 29 years of substantial service, so it was almost completely wiped out the WEP. And she could delay the institution of WEP, the effects of WEP, by delaying taking money out of that defined contribution plan. But if she in the past has ever taken any money out from that, she's already triggered WEP. So just be aware of that. The only way there's a delay in the effects of WEP from one of these accounts, these lump sum accounts that she'd be able to take out, is if you had never taken money out. The moment you take money out, even if it's just a rollover to another account, you didn't distribute it for spending, but you just rolled it over to an IRA or something, the act of doing that triggers the announcement from that pension plan to the Social Security that you have taken it, that you now are eligible and entitled to receive this pension equivalent, and they'll do some calculations to convert that lump sum amount into an effective monthly pension in order to make these WEP adjustments. But in this case, I think he's worrying a lot about something that's going to be a very tiny effect for her because she does have 29 years of substantial earnings here. No GPO issues here to be worried about. He will be likely affected by GPO if he were ever going to be receiving a Social Security benefit on her record. So he's not going to get a spousal benefit and would likely get little or no survivor benefit because of GPO. But he has a CSRS pension, so he didn't give us any of those numbers, so I can't guarantee that it would be completely wiped out. But if he had a whole career under CSRS, those numbers are going to be so big that GPO is going to wipe out anything he might receive. But she's not affected by GPO. She would be only affected by GPO if she was collecting a spousal benefit or survivor benefit on his record. Then she is the spouse for GPO purposes. And that's not the case because he has no Social Security benefit upon which she can claim. So again, I apologize for not converting his terminology in here to WEP at the beginning. It's not until I got a little deeper into the question. That'll teach me not to read the question in full before I record it for you all. So that's the first one. And second question, I said there's quite a bit of difference in a variety of things here. So here's the next one. This, hello, Jim and Chris. Greetings from the great state of Alabama. So we have a listener from Alabama. Points out that their saying is, or their mascot is War Eagle, not Roll Tide. Not sure when we talked about that, but I do vaguely recall at some point we talked about that. Got a couple questions for my father-in-law. Father-in-law turned 70 on June 3rd of 2020. He waited until 70 to claim Social Security benefits. My mother-in-law is 68. She will be receiving spousal benefits as she never qualified for her own benefit. They've been married for 45 years. In late March, my father-in-law and mother-in-law had a phone interview with Social Security to get signed up for benefits. So that's perfectly appropriate. That's timing-wise, that was perfect. He turned 70 in June, wanted to start collecting in June, and so he went in 3 months before that in March. That's exactly what Social Security recommends, that you contact them 3 months before you want to start collecting. So far they're following the rules perfectly. They were told their benefits would begin the second Wednesday in July. So remember, he's going to claim in June. The June benefit is paid a month later in July, specifically, and he pointed out, the second Wednesday of July. Why? Because if you were paying attention at home, he was born on June 3rd. If you're born in the first 10 days of the month, your Social Security retirement pay date is the second Wednesday of the month. So that's why he's going to get his first check the second Wednesday of July. There are some exceptions to that, but generally that's the rule. August comes. Well, July comes, no check, no benefit deposited to their bank account. Father-in-law contacts Social Security, told everything seems okay, but they're a little bit behind because of COVID-19. They were assured benefits would begin in August. August rolls around, no benefits. Father-in-law reaches out, told we have no idea why you didn't receive your benefits, as your file shows we have everything and you should be receiving benefits. He's told they will escalate the issue and they should hear something, an explanation in the mail in the next 30 to 60 days. His question is, should they wait until he hears something or should he do something? Is there someone else he should be contacting? Well, this was sent to us back in August, so they missed their August payment. I reached out because now, as I'm recording this in October, I thought, well, let me check if they got paid. And sure enough, in September, they finally got paid. So here's one where they were a full 60 days late, not because of something they did. They went in 3 months early like they were supposed to. But because of all the COVID issues going on, somehow Social Security got behind. So this is really reflects the fact that there's still way too much manual work that happens behind the scenes at Social Security, because computers don't slow down with COVID, right? So there's a lot of steps and processes and layers of people putting their hands on all these applications that everything slowed down. So here's another reason why modernization of Social Security systems, while extraordinarily expensive, probably would be a good idea. Anyway, side note. So the good news, he's been paid. They paid him then in September and separately made back payments for the July and August payments that were missed. And that is typical. On the second Wednesday of September, he probably got his August payment, and it was just the August payment. The July and August deposits, which would have been for June and July benefits, remember they pay them a month later, are paid separately as kind of a makeup, and those can come at other Wednesdays of the month. So he didn't express when he got those. But the good news in this particular case is they got their money. And if he hadn't gotten the money yet, I would say once you're this late, if something's going wrong, I would escalate it by trying to, it's hard with COVID to make a face-to-face meeting with the local office, but if that is available, I'd do that next, if this hadn't already been resolved. And if that doesn't work, then I would contact my U.S. representative. They have a liaison, Congress has liaisons with the Social Security Administration. They can look into these things for constituents and usually get an answer back from a higher power than the local office personnel or the people that you talk to over the phone and get this resolved. So luckily he didn't have to go through those steps. And honestly, most of the time, I will give Social Security credit, eventually, most of the time, they get it right. It's that eventually part that can sometimes take a really long time. I've seen issues with Social Security missed payments where they can take 6-12 months to finally get everything figured out and someone finally clicking pay so they get paid. So, but the good news is eventually it gets paid. In this case, it was only 60 days late. So hopefully that didn't cause them too much consternation. And once it's set up and on automatic pilot, then they should come out now every single month. Every second Wednesday of the month, he should get his deposit without any future concerns. Okay, here's the next one. So, next question. My wife and I are both retired and receiving Social Security benefits. This one, by the way, comes in from, well, they don't identify where this is coming in from, the USA somewhere. So wife and I are both retired and receiving Social Security benefits. Our son, age 37, is fully disabled and is receiving SSI, that's not SSDI, so that's not disability. He's receiving SSI and Medicaid, and in parentheses, Medi-Cal, so he must be in California. He does work as an adjunct professor with no benefits and low pay, and his SSI payment are offset by his earnings. So SSI is supplemental. It's not Social Security retirement benefits. That is supplemental pay for low-income people. And in this particular case, because of his disability and his low pay, he qualifies for SSI and also for Medicaid. So his earnings must be quite low, even though he does have some earnings. Because he can work, he is not disabled according to SSA, Social Security Administration's definition of disability. So earlier he said fully disabled, but it hasn't been enough to quite meet the disabled label from Social Security. If that was the case, then he would be on SSDI, the Social Security Disability Insurance, but he does not qualify. Or do I have this wrong? Well, the only one who could say for sure whether he qualifies or not is Social Security itself. So I can't judge based on what you've told me if they've made a proper determination of his disability or not. But the fact that he's not receiving SSDI means that you either haven't applied or he's been applied and rejected, and any appeal must not have gone through yet. But they go on, because of his earnings, he is not our dependent, although he lives with us. Is there any way he could receive Social Security benefits under our names? While he did not lose the use of his legs and left arm until he was 26, the cause of the disability was a stroke that he had at age 4. So my understanding is for him to be collecting as a dependent for Social Security purposes under your record, he either has to be a minor or have been disabled before the age, I should have looked this up, either 21 or 23, disabled by as determined by Social Security disability rules, not by other definitions of disabled. That's my understanding. So despite the root cause being at age 4, the fact that he wasn't actually disabled until 26, I would be... I would understand the rules to say that no, he would not qualify for additional benefits under your records as parents because he wasn't determined by Social Security to be disabled before he got too old, and 26 is definitely past the age. I should remember that, 21 or 23. I think it's 21, but all that being said, this is actually beyond my normal area of knowledge in detail. I'm not a Social Security disability expert by any means. There's folks that concentrate just on that one topic. I usually swim in the pool of the retirement benefits, spousal benefits, survivor benefits, etc. While you're swimming around in that pool, it's hard to avoid all exposure to some of the disability rules. So I do know some of them and understand some of them, but I'm going to, you know, put a big asterisk on my answer on this one, that talking to the Social Security disability folks would be the best approach. Maybe there's a rule that the fact that his stroke was at age 4, that they would qualify him for benefits under your record, your parental records, and give him a benefit that he's not yet receiving, even though he hasn't been deemed an eligible person under the SSDI, the disability insurance rules. So I would check into it. It's not, I wouldn't give up hope because of what I said by any means, but I suspect he does not qualify because of the age situation. Okay, so the next one, completely different topic. So this one is going to be, hi Jim and Chris, where'd this come in from? My name's Georgette from Kentucky, so we have one from Kentucky now. So don't watch football, but if I did, I'd be a Patriots fan. I'm sorry, Jim's not on the show, so I'm going to skip this question. No, I'm just kidding. I'm not nearly as spiteful as Jim. So, actually, Patriots aren't nearly as offensive now that they're not winning quite so much. I'm trying to dial in the best Social Security claiming date for me and my husband, and I'm hoping you can provide some guidance. I was born in February 1957, so my full retirement is 66 and 6 months, and my husband was born in September of 1954, so his full retirement age is 66. My full retirement age benefit is about $500 a month. My husband's is $3,000 a month. We want my husband to delay as close to age 70 as possible to get the maximum benefit for him and then for me, as it makes more sense for me to claim a spousal benefit than my much smaller full retirement age benefit. I also believe that when I reach my full retirement age, my spousal benefit will not get any larger than half of his full retirement age benefit. That's true. My understanding is that I can't claim my spousal until he begins to claim his benefit. That's true. Let me stop there. A spousal benefit is unlocked only when the spouse upon whose record you're claiming files themselves. So in this case, she's wanting to claim a spousal benefit on her husband's record. That door only gets opened when he claims. He has to claim, then she's potentially has access to a spousal benefit. When I say potentially, it's only if her own benefit isn't bigger than what that spousal benefit will be. But she can't get one for sure until he files, as long as they're married. If they were divorced and had been divorced at least 2 years and married at least 10, that rule about him claiming goes away. He has to at least be old enough to claim, but he doesn't have to have claimed for a divorced spouse to claim. So keep that in mind if you have similar circumstances to this, but you just happen to be divorced. But since they're married, he has to claim for her to get a spousal benefit. Going on, which effectively reduces his ability to wait until 70. Well, he can still wait till 70, but that also is going to delay, as you've noticed, claiming your spousal benefit. You're not going to get that spousal benefit until he claims. So she goes on, I think that our best claim date to maximize our combined benefit is when I reach my full retirement age in August of 2023. He would be about a year. He's not going to reach 70 until 2024, September of 2024. So her full retirement age will be reached a year before he reaches 70. So he'll only be 69. Can you advise if my assumptions are correct and that you agree? I was originally hoping that I could claim my spousal and he could continue to defer his benefit until he turned 70, but based on what I read, that's gone. That's true. The old file and suspend strategy that would unlock the door for a spousal benefit, that's gone away. So that strategy, which is what she was alluding to there, is not in play. He has to be claiming and receiving a benefit in order for her to get the spousal benefit. So let's look at some of these numbers, because I actually disagree. This is one where I, looking at these numbers ahead of time, I jotted down a few things. So remember, she has a full retirement age benefit herself of $500 a month. So even if she didn't get a spousal benefit, she could get $500 a month. Her husband's full retirement age benefit is $3,000. So what we can deduce from that is her spousal benefit will be a total of $1,500, not on top of the $500 for hers. But if he's claimed and she's reached full retirement age, she should get $1,500 total as a spouse rather than $500 on her own benefit. So that's what she's talking about this whole time, that the spousal is bigger and more attractive than her own benefit. However, I think they should still stick to age 70 for claiming. And the reason for this is that when she claims her benefit, she can get $500 a month, even before he unlocks the door for the spousal benefit. So she could earn $500 a month, which is $6,000, right? 500 times 12. That's $6,000. Now she could, if he had unlocked the door, made a lot more than that, $1,500 or $1,000 more. So she could get, follow my logic, $12,000 more for that year if he starts. And that's where she's headed with her determination that he should claim when she turns her full retirement age, which is when he's 69, because that would give him this extra $12,000. I admit that's true. But let's look at how long it'll take to recover that if he were to delay till 70, so essentially forego the $12,000, she still gets her $6,000, the $500 a month on her own benefit. She can still claim that at full retirement age. Earlier, actually, if she wanted to reduce it and claim it earlier, which might make some sense. But that's not what they're talking about here, so I'm not going to go down that path. So she's going to claim it the $500. She's foregoing the extra $12,000, $1,000 a month that she could get if he had claimed. Let's look at the difference in his benefits. So under my figuring, his benefit at age 70, if his full retirement benefit is $3,000, his benefit at age 70 is going to be 32% bigger than that, or $3,960. If he files at 69, it'll only be $3,720 for his benefit. So she's going to give up $12,000 for him then to get $240 a month extra forever, not just him, but when he passes away, she would continue to get that extra $240 a month as well. We're not talking about the long-term effects here. I just want to point out how long would it take to get back that $12,000 that she's giving up if they stuck to their original plan of him claiming at 70. Well, at $240 a month, $12,000 divided by 240, my figuring, 50 months. That's just over 4 years and 2 months. and they're back to whole, and then they're going to be above, they're going to be ahead after that, and have created the largest survivor benefit for whoever lives longest, which is another, that's the big one I always try to focus on. So here, because the payback, the break-even, if you will, we don't do a lot of break-even analysis in Social Security claiming strategies because we're such big proponents of the highest benefit recipient waiting to 70 to create that biggest, most robust survivor benefit for whoever lives longest, that it isn't all about break-even for us. It's about that longevity protection. But in this case, the break-even is so compelling, in my eyes, that I think they should stick to their original plan. All else being equal, we don't know their whole story, right? So I'm just talking about Social Security as a standalone decision here. Because they're going to get all that $12,000 back in only just over 4 years, I think they should stick to the original plan. Her claim at full retirement age, they may as well collect the $500 a month while she's waiting for him to unlock the door for the spousal. Then a year later when he files, her benefit will go from $500 to $1,500, and he'll still get his maximized age 70 benefit. I like that approach better. So when the question was, do you I agree? No, actually, I don't. In this particular case, I don't agree. I think you should stick to the age 70 program you had before and make sure that you file for your own benefit and collect that year's worth of $500 a month. Essentially, you're being paid to wait is what we call that. You're not sitting there collecting nothing. You're at least getting the $500 a month. So the numbers look favorable in this particular case for that strategy. Okay, so next one here. This one's got a few numbers involved as well. Hello, Jim and Chris. I listen to your podcasts every week and enjoy them very much and have learned a lot. This one came in from another one from California. So George from California. I'm working on planning my retirement as a do-it-yourselfer, and I'm having trouble with your advice to wait until 70 to turn on Social Security payments. So reading through this, he does have a spouse, never mind. So he's doubting the logic of delaying till 70, okay? My plan is to retire around 64, and my estimated Social Security payments should be around $2,000. If I wait until 70, it'll increase to around $3,000. By my calculations, that is $144,000 of payments over the six-year period. So rolling this back, if he retires at 64 and immediately claims, he's going to collect $2,000 a month for that six-year period. That's $144,000 that he wouldn't otherwise collect if he waited till 70. It would take me 12 years at the higher amount to make up this difference. So he's going down that path of break-even. He's trying to figure out when's the break-even point. And I'll tell you all, the break-even point is always in your early to mid-80s. This is a mathematical reality. That's because these benefit calculations that they have, for the most part, are based on median life expectancy, which is in the 83, 84 category. So when he says by his figuring, it's 12 years to break even, well, 70 plus 12, guess what? 82 years old. So 82, 83, that's exactly what we're talking about. He's thinking, I'm going to be in my early 80s before I get this money back. I won't have collected back my $144,000 I gave up. I admit that's true. In addition to fund spending, I skipped over something. It would take me 12 years. Not to mention that I might also need to spend down savings over those 6 years. Well, likely you would, right? You're not collecting Social Security, so you'd have to make up the difference with your own spending. In addition to fund spending, if I didn't turn on Social Security at retirement, if I take distributions to make up the difference, those might be taxed by state and federal, while Social Security is only partially taxed. That's true, but it's about 85. If you have decent income and you're distributing from retirement accounts, creating taxes, then your Social Security is likely to be taxed at the 85% level, although his Social Security is not taxed in his state, while his other income is. Please help me understand why waiting until 70 makes sense in my situation. He goes on to include that in retirement, I'm going to get a pension, about $4,800 a month, continued medical insurance, and rental income of $1,500. So he's got all this other income coming in. That's why 85% of his Social Security is going to be taxable. My wife always also has a pension and Social Security, a little less than mine. We also have 401ks, etc. I'm not worried about running out of money, but whatever we don't need or spend, we want to leave to our children. and maybe our favorite podcast host. I like that one. Thanks so much for your podcast, blah, blah, blah. Okay. So he's going to give up the $1,000 a month if he waits till 70. The $2,000 will grow to $3,000. He'd give that up as a long-term benefit in exchange for receiving the $2,000. So he can increase his benefit by about $1,000 a month or $12,000 a year if he were to wait to 70. But he's doubting that because of the break-even point that that makes a lot of sense. Well, the first thing I'll say is it's true that other assets you have could be left behind, but you can't leave behind the Social Security. So the first thing I would always do in a case like this where people are doubting the logic of delaying is look at their whole situation first. This is where looking at Social Security as a standalone decision I don't like. That's because we have to determine how important Social Security is in the overall plan, particularly how important is the long-term benefits of an inflation-adjusted annual income that Social Security represents. How important is that in the overall scheme of things? Well, he's essentially saying that he's not really worried about the Social Security. He's not worried about running out of money. They've got other pension income and good medical insurance and rental income coming in. He's not that worried about that part. But he realizes any money out of his brokerage or Roth or 401k accounts that he spends won't go to his heirs as an inheritance. And the Social Security wouldn't either. If it's bigger, it's not like creating that bigger benefit can ultimately go to them. So I'd start looking there. If the Social Security becomes inconsequential overall, that you could take it or leave it, I would then say, we could do some fancy financial calculations, but you're right, the break-even point is way out. And if it's not really going to affect your ability to spend and enjoy retirement the way that you want, when you claim it is more going to be more of an emotional or philosophical decision as much as anything. You could start making arguments of, oh, I can take it and I'm going to invest it and I'm going to do all these other cockamamie things. I can make you pretty much any argument that you're trying to make with certain assumptions on both sides of that. So I would back up and assign an importance level, 1 to 10 or something, on the Social Security as part of your overall retirement plan. Looks like he's kind of minimizing it here. So I would say, man, I'm not that concerned about you claiming it earlier, because as long as it's not going to undermine your wife in a survivorship scenario, as long as not having that extra $1,000 a month isn't going to matter in her scenario, I wouldn't be too concerned. Now, if the projections show in survivorship, she has kind of a hard time because the survivor benefit has been cut because you claimed it at 64 instead of later. That, but she has a benefit. We need to assess. He doesn't say how much it is. It just says a little less than his. So we'd have to know some numbers to crunch some things. We'd have to look at survivorship scenarios. But let's get back to the value of the Social Security. Let me make this point. Let's say that the income is somewhat important to them, ultimately. He thinks it's not, but when he really looks at it in the projections, it turns out Social Security is a bigger piece of what they're relying on long-term than he anticipated. So it's important to get this right. If that's the case, let's think of it this way. The comparison I always make is, what would I get if I took the $144,000, so if I took those payments instead, and took that and tried to replace with that the $1,000 a month that Social Security would have given me if I delayed, if I gave up the $144,000 of benefits between age 64 and 70, what does Social Security give me? And he already told us, they give him an extra $1,000 a month, inflation adjusted, keep that in mind. So he'd get an extra $12,000 a year in 2020 terms, and that'll be inflation adjusted. So what I did is I went and I looked to see what other alternatives might he have to generate income that behaves like Social Security, regular recurring income that comes in. What would he have to pay to buy $12,000 a year, that $1,000 a month that he'd have to generate with that $144,000? Well, it would take $230,000. Where did I get that? I went on a publicly available resource. If you go to, and there's several of these, the one I like is immediateannuities.com. On there, you can get SPIA quotes. A SPIA is the most straightforward way of turning a lump sum of money into an income stream guaranteed by an insurance company. I didn't happen to use immediateannuities.com because I have a wholesale tool in order to poll many different insurance companies to see what they would charge for this, and I happen to use that. But you can get similar information from immediateannuities.com. The reason I like that is they'll give you quotes without forcing you to hand over your information. They don't play that game that they all usually play where they tease you like they're going to actually give you information, and then at the end they will promise to email it to you if you give them your name, address, the name of your firstborn, the color of your eyes, and all that kind of stuff. I don't like that. So immediate annuities doesn't make you do that. They'll just tell you. They'll tell you what an annuity will cost you given your age, the state where you reside, whether it's a single annuity or a joint annuity with your spouse. It's a nice tool if you're trying to figure out how to generate income from an annuity, if you're interested in that. And I'm talking specifically a single premium immediate annuity, the very essence of an annuity. Well, 230. Well, in my book, 230 is a lot bigger than 144. I couldn't take that 144 and buy 230. Now you could say, well, I could invest that along the way. Well, maybe. Maybe you could have it grow to 230, but we're talking a six-year period. If you can find me an investment that will guarantee the 144, again, the 144 isn't going to come in as a lump sum, so it's going to come in as the $1,000 a month for that whole six-year period. You're not going to get a guarantee like that in today's interest rate environment. And oh, by the way, that annuity has no inflation adjustment. Social Security does. So that's even making the Social Security more attractive. An annuity that increases every year at 2%. If we assume that there's 2% increase average, so we want an annuity that does that. Now, Social Security, of course, adjusts by CPI, which varies every year. The historical average of Social Security COLAs is between 2.5 and 3. So if we be really conservative, in my eyes, and assume 2 in the annuity to try to replicate the kind of cost of living adjustment I'm going to get from Social Security, the cost of that annuity goes from 230 to 290, more than double the 144 that Social Security is willing to sell you a similar annuity for, because that's what they're doing. They're saying, let us keep the $144,000 and in exchange, we'll give you an extra $1,000 a month for the rest of your life, inflated at CPI every year. So you're essentially, by delaying Social Security, buying extra annuity income from them. That's the effect of it. It's not practically that, you know, it's not technically that, but it has the effect of doing that. And if we raise the cost of living adjustment, let's say cost of living adjustments go back up closer to 3. If I try to buy an annuity with a 3% inflation rate every single year, $325,000 is what insurance companies today would want for a $12,000 a year annuity growing at 3% every year. 325 is a heck of a lot bigger than 144. So those are some of the reasons why you might want to reconsider. Now, again, if the Social Security is not that important to you and you'd prefer to take it earlier and it doesn't undermine your long-term retirement plan, go ahead and take it, I'd say. Don't let me try to convince you to delay to 70. But if that higher benefit shows to be very positively impactful and very reassuring, especially in a survivorship scenario, you're never going to come close in this interest rate environment in generating extra income by getting dollars in hand and turning around and trying to buy extra income later in life compared to the extra Social Security will give you by foregoing payments and delaying. I just proved it to you right here. Now, this story works today when I'm recording this in a low interest rate environment. Social Security benefits aren't affected directly by interest rates. Some astute individuals out there might realize that when interest rates are higher, that usually means that cost of living adjustments are higher. Those go hand in hand. I admit that, but let's leave that complexity out of here. The base benefit you receive when they calculate it has nothing to do with interest rates. So in a low interest rate environment, Social Security becomes extra attractive compared to alternatives. In a high interest rate environment, annuities get better priced because that's how an insurance company can pay you that annuity. They take your money and invest it at going interest rates and then make those promised payments to you for the rest of your life. In this particular case, interest rates are really low. So these are high quotes for SPIAs. But this is the reality today and might very well be the reality in the not too distant future as well. Sounds like interest rates, they're going to try to keep low for some time if you listen to the Fed. Don't know for sure, but that's what they're talking. So in this environment, and the environment we've been having for the past decade or so, Social Security kicks the butt of annuity income when you compare it on a like-for-like kind of basis. So keep that in mind. Maybe that will entice you to delay to 70. But again, if it turns out Social Security is a minor part of your overall situation and you're not really reliant upon it, taking it early may not be that big a deal. Okay. Last one. This is more of a, comment, I guess. But this one comes in from Pennsylvania. Thanks for having your blog on helpwithmysocialsecurity.com. So again, that's the blog focused on Social Security questions. My wife had zero earnings recorded by Social Security for a time period 10 years ago. We called into Social Security and went into the local office. They collected the information but never processed it. We went in 3 times. When COVID hit, I searched on your blog and it referenced the proper form to correct the earnings. I have a blog post about this, about correcting your earnings record. Sometimes there are mistakes, most of the time because an employer didn't send in the right payroll records, particularly an employer that was going out of business. They never filed the final forms in the last year or something. We see that all the time. But for whatever reason, Social Security did not properly record your earnings record, and it is that earnings record they base your benefit on. So it's important that you get all credit for all the earnings you've had. So I wrote an article about this on the blog. We submitted all the information, and 5 months later, her earnings are now properly recorded. We thought we'd have to get our representative involved, that congressperson I referenced, which is the last step in escalating issues you have with Social Security. But they say, but all we really needed was the proper form and mailing it ourselves to Social Security headquarters. This is great to hear. I'm always tickled when something that we put out there helps somebody. And here they were helped. They helped themselves by finding the right form. I put a link to that in there. So if you go to helpwithmysocialsecurity.com and search for correcting your earnings record, or just search in the search box earnings record, those blog posts will come up. But for those of you interested in this particular topic, the form he references is SSA-7708. It's titled Request for Correction of Earnings Record. They know this happens. It happens more frequently than we would like. They have a form all ready to go for this where you provide all your information, you mail it into them, and like this person, if they believe what you've sent them is enough evidence that they need to correct the earnings record, they do it. And in this case, they did exactly that. Some of those records, by the way, this is important why you just general comments here. I recommend you check your earnings record every couple of years, because later on, if you find out later, they will correct things for a certain period. But oftentimes there's kind of a 3-year statute of limitations. They've been not really strict on enforcing that in my experience, but there technically can be this limit on how long before you can point out errors. So I recommend you check every couple of years at least your earnings record and make sure it's right so you can get it corrected before there's any issues. Plus the issue of your own evidence might be hard to come by. I don't know about you, but I don't really have the employment records for my job from 15 years ago. If I was trying to prove to Social Security I really did have a job and paid into Social Security and here's my pay stubs to prove it or something, it'd be impossible for me to pull that up if that employer was out of business, for instance. If they're still around, hopefully they might have it in a box somewhere. But this is why checking it and correcting it early is good, because then you're likely to have the evidence and you won't have any statute of limitations issues going on here. So that form, if you need to fix your earnings record, SSA-7708, and apparently for this person in particular, it was more helpful. It got the job done when visits to the actual Social Security office didn't. And that's the same form they should have filled out for this person. I don't know what they did, but it clearly didn't get done. But I'm glad. So I'm really happy to hear that. SSA 7708. So that's the last one I have. Knocked out a bunch here. Glad we whittled that down. So the next shows, we can start digging into some of the other topics once Jim's back and he shares what his elk harvesting experience was. We'll find out what that is next time. Want to thank everybody for listening again. This was probably more boring than normal because it was just my voice droning on and on and on without the interesting interjections from Jim. But hopefully you found this a little bit helpful. And if you have your own question, feel free to reach out. Go to our website, jimhelps.com. That's Jim, H-E-L-P-S.com. On there, there's a contact form. You can submit questions for us to handle on the Q&A show. You can research a little bit more about what we do. We're retirement planners specifically. That's our area of specialty and focus. That's why we deal with Social Security so much. But right there is where you can check us out. Reach out to us if you're interested in maybe working with us in the future. And in particular, sending us questions for the Q&A show. We really appreciate that. So everybody take care, stay healthy, and I will be back with Jim next week with a brand new show.
You have listened to Jim on the radio, read his quotes in the media, and enjoyed his banter on iTunes. But even now, you may wonder what sets Jim Salmier and Associates apart from other financial planning companies. The answer is quite simple. Jim's diverse team of professionals specializes in retirement planning. They form a lifelong relationship with you and measure their success not through product sales, but through the security and prosperity you may achieve in your retirement. Jim's entire team shares his unwavering commitment to placing their clients' best interests first while offering their services at fair prices with full disclosures. The professionals at Jim Salmier & Associates are available to assist you with your retirement planning needs. Visit jimhelps.com to schedule your complimentary coffee and a second opinion meeting. That's Jim, H-E-L-P-S.com. Or call 970-530-0556.
The Retirement and IRA Show represents the words and views of the show hosts exclusively and should not be construed as investment, legal, or tax advice. All information is believed to be from reliable sources. However, we make no representation as to its completeness or accuracy. All economic and performance information is historical in nature and is not indicative of any future results. Any indices mentioned on the show are unmanaged and cannot be invested in directly. Diversification and asset allocation strategies do not assure profit or protect against loss. Never make any investment or financial decisions based on information offered on this show without first consulting your financial, legal, or tax advisor. Securities offered through Cambridge Investment Research Incorporated, a broker-dealer member FINRA SIPC. Advisory services offered through Cambridge Investment Research Advisors Incorporated, a registered investment advisor. Financial planning services offered through Jim Salmier & Associates, LLC, a registered investment advisor. Jim Salmier & Associates, LLC, and Cambridge are not affiliated.